Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language. So that happened. This week, we have a bank dork treat for everyone as we are joined by author and historian Eric Rauchway to talk about his most recent book, The Moneymakers, and how FDR getting our currency off the gold standard is the gold standard of economic policy. Meanwhile, a bill that would allow the victims of terrorism to sue the states that sponsor such acts has passed the House, and it's on the way to the president's desk, where it is sure to be vetoed. However, this bill has such broad and bipartisan support that we may be on the verge of a first ever congressional override of an Obama veto. How did the White House end up here? We'll lay it out for you. Finally, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has levied a huge fine on Wells Fargo after it was revealed that thousands of Wells Fargo employees were routinely and purposefully charging their customers scads of bogus fees. It was a dumb and venal scam that we're all glad was caught by the CFPB, but can a hefty fine really cure a diseased corporate culture? I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Jessica Schulberg, and Lauren Weber. We'll have all of that, but first, let us briefly stick a hand into our basket of deplorables. Your week in 2016-ishness begins right now. Hey, guys, welcome back. We've got a podcast for you. This is So That Happened, your week of political nonsense. I'm Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press. Not Meet the Press, but Eat the Press. I understand it was confusing some people, and I apologize for my poor diction at times. We have a really great show for you today. In order to get to it, we've got to get through a segment on the fucking election. So here to begin talking about the election.
Summing up all our feelings.
We have Zach Carter.
Woo! Let's talk about this fucking shit.
Feigning excitement. And our good friend Lauren Weber is also here.
I'm bringing a tisket, a tasket, and a deplorables basket.
Yeah, that's where we're going with this.
God.
It's probably how I would have introduced this segment, so thank you for sparing me that indignity. This weekend was full up of nonsense, beginning with Hillary Clinton saying what I would have thought to have been one of the least controversial things she's ever said, which is to say that a goodly portion, she said half, and maybe that was too much, but half of Donald Trump's support belong in a basket of deplorables, while the other half belong to a group of people who have been so economically deprived over this period of time they no longer believe that anything in the country is working for them, and those people deserve empathy, but the whole white nationalist nonsense movement does not. I was a bit thunderstruck by how suddenly this became controversial. It literally is one of the least controversial things I've ever heard her say. This is a woman who said, I gave speeches at Goldman Sachs because of 9/11.
Which is a whole nother issue for another day.
Like, that would have been the thing that if I were in the news, I would have said, come on, guys, that's fucking crazy. But instead, what's crazy is apparently what the same media has been reporting about for the better part of a year and a half. Right? Am I nuts here?
I mean, look, it's interesting to me that a few weeks ago, this was there was a debate between people on Twitter who are not quite media elites, but who do fine, about whether Donald Trump's support was due 100% due to only racism or whether it was due to a mixture of both racism and economic anxiety. And there was a significant faction of Hillary Clinton supporters, including Matt Iglesias, most prominent among them at Vox, saying it was 100% racism. Nothing but race explains Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton is basically saying Matt was half wrong. She is saying actually everybody else who was saying, I think there's an economic component, they're about half right.
Right.
Only half of the Trump campaign is full of these deplorables. And look, let's not pretend that there isn't a white nationalist movement out there that's behind Donald Trump. We see the freaking frog memes on Twitter, okay?
There's a whole... they get really angry when you point out that the frog meme is a sort of a racist byword. But,
I really like this theory that Hillary Clinton said this to disprove some mid-level reporters on Twitter. I really like that. That's why she decided to say this phrase.
Well, I mean, it's become uninteresting to me because I made up my mind about this like 6 months ago. But there is still this debate about what is responsible for the rise of Donald Trump and his popularity, because he's such a unique and malevolent force in American politics. And so that's something that people still debate. And so what Hillary Clinton was putting out there was basically like, well, yeah, it's kind of both. She was saying something that pretty much everybody in the space who has looked at this and analyzed it has said some version of, if not stronger. Than the terms that she used. Now, it is, I think, problematic to refer to people as, like, basically irredeemable. I think that is in its
she
own way a sort
deplorable
of...
Deplorable is not irredeemable.
It's
I am deplorable a lot of the time.
I think it was a thing that she just could have avoided, though. Like, did we need to say this and then create this media firestorm? Like, did we need to take away the distraction Donald Trump's...
I don't think we ever need
nightmares.
To.
Like, you know, we could have just let him continue to slide instead of distracting ourselves with this.
I think there's ever the need to create a media firestorm. I think that often media firestorms crop up where you least expect it.
Okay.
Part of, you know, one of the central parts that made this a media firestorm is that the people doing all of the reporting of her remarks omitted the second part of what Zach is saying.
That's true. And that is not what was heard.
It makes you wonder that if she had led with the other in the first place, maybe this wouldn't have gotten reported as such. But, you know, it is what it is.
I think there's a difference between calling something deplorable and saying someone belongs in a basket of deplorables. It suggests that you are no longer like this thing with agency and emotions that can change over time and learn. It suggests that you're just kind of one of the bad people and needs to be set aside in your own little basket. And I do think there is something about
that. There's something demeaning about that.
Yeah, that does get people's raise people's hackles. But look, it's also the case that there are a lot of like really hardline white nationalists behind Donald Trump. Okay, and there's got to be a way to denounce that and criticize that and describe that in very unappealing terms.
You know,
because it's pretty bad and it's becoming mainstreamed through the. I mean, you can see it with the whole term alt-right is now a thing, whereas before it was just called white
Neo-Nazis.
Nationalism or neo-Nazism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And you know, I want to point out that the same day that Hillary Clinton said this, there was an alt-right neo-Nazi press conference in which they basically said, yeah, we're looking to establish a, you know, white nationalist ethno state. And I have to assume that they meant here in America, not some undiscovered country. So that is out
Maybe
there.
Maybe it's a Bitcoin country. We can only hope.
And even after the fact, Trump was nodding at them saying, I see you. Don't worry. Keep up the good work. But you know what raises my hackles about it, to be honest with you, is just the media kind of abandoning the story they've been telling and sensationalizing maybe a little, perhaps, over the course of a year and a half. The New York Times put out a soundtrack of Donald Trump supporters at rallies in which they build as like the raw and uncensored real views of Donald Trump supporters. And it wasn't that what they didn't capture on tape was, yeah, you know, my plant closed. OK, that's not what they were talking about. This is the kind of the way the media has treated this. And I start to question whether they have the stomach for the confrontation they've initiated. And I think back to the fact that the media didn't care that much about it when Donald Trump was stoking anti-Mexican resentment, or when he was stoking
banning all Muslims from the country.
Like the first time the media finally said, hey, that's beyond the pale, was when Donald Trump went after John McCain, a member of the elite political class. And really what's turned them onto it is the fact that Donald Trump now regularly turns his audiences against reporters, and reporters now feel threatened with violence. Katie Turr wrote an essay for Marie Claire magazine about what it's like to have, you know, come from England and abandon her boyfriend and to follow Trump on the road. And the part of the story that everyone in the media picked up on was the fact that Trump called her out at a rally, turned the audience against her, and the Secret Service took the extraordinary step of actually escorting her out of that venue in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina.
For her safety, right?
For her safety. Yes. That's what everyone was like. Oh, and everyone was like, oh, Katie Turr, I can't believe this happened to you. Oh, I can't believe you're so brave. And you know what? I'm not here to knock Katie Turr. She is brave, and she's done a good job on the campaign trail. But the media was like all about this basket of deplorables when it's turned on one of their own. And they actually gave Hillary Clinton a lot of props for the speech she gave in Reno, Nevada, which was entirely focused on the basket of deplorables.
She just didn't call it a basket of deplorables.
Yes, so
it's also, I mean, it's also just such like a hypocritical. I mean, this sticks to Hillary Clinton, and yet Donald Trump says things that are so beyond the pale every 5 seconds that nothing matters.
But, you know, I am sort of wondering if what's happening here, if we're missing while all this is going on, that particularly people who are sort of more on the liberal end of the spectrum, like myself, you see Donald Trump all over here basically running a fascist campaign that terrifies right-thinking people, okay? And
conservative and liberal people, right, rational right. people on both sides, yeah.
And it terrifies a lot of people.
And Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, is a person who went to Donald Trump's wedding, who vacations with Henry Kissinger, who is now touting the endorsement of Mike Morrell, who was an apologist for the CIA's torture program under Bush and Cheney. Are we missing, you know, while we're talking about the awful ethno-nationalism of the Donald Trump campaign, which is very real, are we missing a movement in a more militaristic direction that the Clinton campaign is making in order to highlight its ability to take Republican support away from Donald Trump?
That seems to have been her post-convention plan for a long period of time, to attempt to peel off Republican support. And what's interesting about that is that during this period of time, the polls have tightened. I'm not going to doomsay about it.
No, but they've gotten closer.
They've gotten closer. And I think that was probably a strategic error. And I think a lot of liberals noticed that she was shifting to something that seemed a lot more militaristic. And yeah, it can become kind of strange to compare and contrast these two candidates when you have one who's been sort of overtly authoritarian and fascist, and the other one is just sort of more of this kind of like, well, soft power, and we'll do it to other people, not to our fellow countrymen. I'm sympathetic to your point of view on that, Zach.
I love that when that happens.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad we were able to. Everyone, rest assured, me and Zach are cool.
Glad to hear it, guys. Glad to hear it. We're having this bro moment right now.
The rest of the country, maybe.
Do you want to like get a drink after this?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. I'm pretty sure people weren't sleeping at night thinking it was not okay.
Right. Really... Okay. Well, we have a really good show coming up, so please stick around. We are going to be right back. Welcome back. Wells Fargo, the bank most prominently known for being a song in The Music Man, has been making a lot of news lately. A few weeks ago, they put out an ad campaign talking about how their great student loans could help rock musicians become botanists, get real careers. And I couldn't help but wonder if maybe like their contributions to the financial crash had made it more logical to bootstrap your way to a career with a bass guitar than to...
I gotta say that one I took a little personally.
Of course you did.
As a former rock musician who found a real career, I did not actually need a loan to do that.
Exactly.
I needed a job.
Exactly. Yeah. But the best was yet to come in the world of Wells Fargo, because America's friends at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has dinged them up for a massive and really kind of dickish scam that their employees were pulling. So to explain it, let's turn to Zach Carter. Zach, talk to me about sandbagging.
So this is an amazing scandal, as bank scandals go, because even though the actual dollar amount of the fraud here, alleged fraud, they've settled without acknowledging wrongdoing, so it's still alleged. But we do know that Wells Fargo employees, 5,300 of them, who have since been fired from Wells Fargo, created literally millions of fake accounts for their own customers in order for these salespeople, the retail salespeople working at, you know, Wells Fargo branches, to meet internal sales goals. So let's say you had a checking account. Oh, look, you have a credit card that's opened. Okay, now you have fees that are associated with this credit card, and you're being charged these fees. So ultimately, these millions of accounts resulted in only about $2.5 million in charges to Wells Fargo customers. But it is just such an obvious, scummy thing to do. Yeah. And it was happening on a massive, massive scale.
It's the venality of it that really staggers me. You're right. It didn't cost consumers a ton of money, although God knows you wake up one day and find out that you've been being charged fees for a credit card you never opened. That doesn't feel good. And you feel I do feel like you get nickel and dime by banks enough.
Let's say you actually did like incur an overdraft fee on your checking account or something, and you want to get that reversed because like you actually did screw up, but you think it's kind of ridiculous that they've charged you this many overdraft fees or something.
Right.
Good luck. OK, you go into the bank and say, hey, I never even opened that account. I mean, have a good time with the customer service rep on that one, right?
Yeah, that's plainly ridiculous. And this is being done at a staggering scale. 5,300 employees were all sort of in on this together. Was this a coordinated thing they were all doing with each other?
It was not
coordinated.
Or
was it kind of just like one of those things that, where the company policies incentivize this kind of activity and enough people took the hit and started doing it?
You have put your finger on exactly what happened.
Great.
And so, you know, 5,300 people over the course of 5 years suggests that maybe there's something going wrong in the management structure. That we have a clear cultural problem here at Wells Fargo where all of our employees are creating fake accounts over and over again, which is illegal. 5 years of this suggests that somebody in management knew what was going wrong because they were firing people over it, and it was happening over and over and over again. So to my mind, there are a couple of lessons here. One, Wells Fargo, which has like sort of enjoyed this bizarre reputation as one of the like best of the big banks. You know, Goldman Sachs is bad because of the Abacus scandal that happened in 2008,
right,
where
yeah.
they were defrauding their own, you know, investment banking clients,
sure.
Their own securities clients. J.P. Morgan Chase is a bad bank because look at all the, you know, 12 dozen scandals they've had in commodities markets, energy markets, what have you, mortgage markets. Wells Fargo is supposed to be like one of the cleaner big banks. I think that just shows that this is all been a big marketing scam, essentially, from Wells Fargo. And I also think, you know, the CFPB did their job here, and Wells Fargo is going to pay $185 million to clear this out. But there should be a criminal investigation into this. This is the sort of thing that, I mean, they've discussed their retail sales on to investors many times, and those retail sales numbers were not accurate because
they were padded by the scam.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they have misled investors on something that, you know, look, we're talking $2.5 million, but the numbers for accounts, you know, if you're telling investors, hey, we've opened 2 million accounts that don't actually exist, that suggests that those accounts are going to 2 million accounts could be has a potential profit margin that's much larger than the fraud on people who lost $2.5 million on those accounts.
Yeah.
So they've misled investors, and they did it through you know, I think at best what looks to me like negligence. And you can bring criminal prosecutions against executives for negligence. So there should be a criminal inquiry opened into this bank. It probably will not happen because the Obama administration just doesn't prosecute big bankers.
They've got no stomach for it at all. And it's disturbing that we get down to this kind of petty level where this is like really kind of just like a gross thing that's been consequential for like ordinary people. We're not talking about the kind of like scams that wiped out big institutional investors. We're talking about the kind of nickel and diming of ordinary people. These are the people that you'd think the Obama administration would want to protect.
Right, right. The Obama administration has been pretty good, actually, about consumer issues and finance. They haven't been so great on consumer issues with mortgages, but on basically everything else, you know, the CFPB has been really solid. The thing is, even if you don't agree with me that this is something that where a criminal investigation is important and we need to bring prosecutions here, you have to really ask yourself what's going on if the bank's defense is true. The bank's defense is essentially these were a few bad apples, 5,300 bad apples over the course of 5 years. If it's really the case that people at the top of Wells Fargo or even in the middle of Wells Fargo can't figure out that there is a trend of people defrauding their customers, thousands of employees defrauding millions of customers for years at a time, if that's really happening, then maybe that bank is not just too big to fail, but actually just too big to manage. Maybe it's the case that Wells Fargo is just at a state where this bank no longer is functioning in an efficient or functional manner. And so what you need to do is break the bank up. That doesn't mean you fire everybody who works at the bank. It doesn't mean you liquidate the accounts. It means you just have seven banks where there used to be one. Right. So everybody works for a different bank now. And those different banks are maybe able to manage their accounts well. I also think it's important to, you know, one of the biggest investors in Wells Fargo is a guy who a lot of our listeners have heard of. His name is Warren Buffett. He's one of the richest men in the world. He runs Berkshire Hathaway. He's a, you know, a super billionaire. And Warren Buffett often is portrayed as sort of like one of the good billionaires.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
He's a guy who, you know, he's always in favor of higher taxes on the rich. Democrats often roll him out. Obama has talked about him.
He's
talked about
been
the
on
Buffett
the stump
rule.
With Hillary.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
He's not the greedy, evil, venal guy, right? But if you look at his holdings, okay, he made a big investment in Goldman Sachs during the financial crisis, and he said since that he made that investment because he knew that the federal government would bail out Goldman Sachs if they got into trouble.
Right.
So he made a very profitable investment because, in large part, he believed that the federal government would hold the bag if things didn't go well for him. So he was able to charge a particularly high rate on that investment when he bought into Goldman during the crisis. He also, Berkshire Hathaway, is the majority shareholder, is a huge shareholder in Moody's, the
credit rating agency.
These guys are, I think it's unfair when people claim that credit rating agencies are responsible for the crisis because everybody on Wall Street knew that there was a giant, you know, fraudulent scheme going on here. It's not just the credit rating agencies who were like tricking everybody, but they were a tool that were used to trick everybody into thinking that incredibly risky stuff was actually super safe. He also has holdings in that. He controls Clayton Homes, which is a mobile home manufacturing company, and they've done all sorts of really scummy things with low-income people, as investigations, journalistic investigations have shown over the last few years. So my point here is that rich people who control really big stuff, even if they mean well, even if they seem to have good public morals the way Warren Buffett does, do not have the capacity at best to manage these things in a way that actually helps the public. It's too much stuff. It's too big. Even if you give Warren Buffett the benefit of the doubt here, his investment in Wells Fargo, he was not able to oversee to prevent this from happening. The managers at Wells Fargo were not able to prevent this from happening. And, you know, he's also operating all these other financial entities that are doing things that are really questionable and not questionable. They're just not good.
Yeah. So related to this kind of culture you're describing, let's say off the top that, you know, on the show, we've constantly touted the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as an agency and government that's really working for people and is really trying to do a good job. And I feel like they showed up in this instance. But there's one thing that they obviously weren't able to prevent, and that is the fact that Kerry Tolstadt, who is the executive who essentially oversaw she presided over the people who perpetrated the scam. She's walking away from this, and she's walking away with $125 million in terms of golden parachute. That, to me, is also super scandalous. But there's nothing that anyone can really do
about. She's been ousted, and she's getting a big severance package, essentially, to leave. But look, it's not fair to just pin this all on her, okay?
Of course not.
Stumpf, who's the CEO of Wells Fargo, regularly makes, you know, dozens of millions of dollars a year, or at least more than one dozen millions of dollars a year. You know, what's he making that money for, okay? He's supposed to be getting paid that much money because he's doing such a great job managing the company.
Yeah.
And if he can't control middle managers and keep things like this from happening, then he's not actually managing the company. He's not actually in control. He's just a guy who happens to sit in a seat where large numbers of dollars flow. So I think it shows a general corporate governance failure with American the way we have come to understand American capitalism, which I think used to be a little bit problematic versus other global capitalist sort of systems, but it's become so concentrated. Every industry, you know, finance is not the only industry where this is happening. We have so much consolidation. The meat industry, there's like four producers of meat in the United States. We think there are all these farmers, okay, sure, but they're all making stuff for four different meat companies, all right?
Right.
this is, you know, your toothpaste. You know, there's only a couple of places that actually make toothpaste, okay? Even though you've got all these different brands in the grocery store, there's only a couple people that actually make toothpaste. This has happened in a lot of different industries, and they've become so big that there's no way to adequately monitor the scope of these operations. Human beings are still human beings. And so we either need to be very serious about breaking these things up, or we need to say, okay, if you want to be responsible for these giant endeavors and make tens of millions of dollars a year, you are going to run the risk of a serious criminal prosecution. And I don't know how many people really want to be the CEO if they start seeing that they themselves can be criminally liable for the things that these companies do.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, CEO pay, staggeringly high. Golden parachutes like this one, staggeringly high. The argument for all this is like, oh, if this wasn't staggeringly high, we wouldn't be able to attract the talent. I keep asking, where's the fucking talent?
Right.
And why don't we apply that same rubric to, say, public school teachers?
Look, if a newspaper accidentally defrauded, you know, hundreds of its subscribers,
right,
it would be a giant scandal and they would stop having subscribers, right?
Right.
It would stop happening. You can't do that in banking because there's only so many places to go to bank, right?
Yeah.
There are several banks that effectively in different regions control all your access to banking. So if you want to go to a bank, all right, well, maybe you've got a choice between Wells Fargo and Bank of America. Okay, who's the good guy there? You tell me.
Your pillow, your mattress. All right, Zach Carter, thanks for talking with us about Wells Fargo and their scumminess. We'll be right back.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And we're back. We're back now to talk about Jasta, which sounds like so much fun. Everyone say it, Jasta.
Are Jasta. You a Jastafarian?
Yeah, it's so, yes, it sounds like fun. It sounds like a fresh new energy drink or something. Drink some Jasta, grab it. But actually, it's a very sober-minded thing. It is the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act.
Mm.
This is something that Congress has proposed, and it's wildly popular in Congress. It would change a 1976 law and allow plaintiffs to sue other nations in federal court if those nations are found to have been involved in a terrorist attack.
And help you stay up later when you're drunk.
Yes. Yeah. It's you know, they hung that on the Christmas tree, too, yeah. And that might pass. But this obviously has put one nation in particular a little bit on the hook, Saudi Arabia. Joining us to talk about this and what President Obama is going to do and what Congress is then going to do in response to President Obama, we have Zachary Carter.
Hi.
And we have our beloved doomsayer, Jessica Schulberg.
Wow, I got a much better intro than Zach did.
I get to be on this all the time, so yeah. Jason's already used all the good ones on me.
Got it.
So let's talk about JASTA. This is wildly popular in Congress.
It is.
It's going to end up on the president's desk.
It is.
The president, he doesn't want any part of this.
The president has already said he'll veto it. What would make this interesting is it looks like there's actually enough votes in the House and the Senate to override a presidential veto. That requires 2/3 votes in both chambers, which means that you would need a lot of Democrats to buck the president. We've never seen Congress get enough votes to override a veto since President Obama came to office. I think one time when people thought it might have been close was on the Iran deal, when Congress was hoping to scuttle the Iran deal, and Obama laid a ton of pressure on Democrats to stay off of that vote. It's unclear if he would have the same lobbying force on this bill. It's a lot more politically complicated.
Yeah, and it's coming at a time just past the September 11th attacks. This is preeminent in people's mind. Zach, you want to say something?
Well, from the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, to be clear, that
was 15 years ago.
Oh,
God, sorry.
Another
one.
Yeah.
I mean, well, the United States has been sort of – there are members of Congress who have been really – who've openly questioned the United States allegiance with Saudi Arabia. We've been allies with them for decades now. Chris Coons is somebody who's – or not Chris Coons, Chris Murphy. The other Chris, the other white guy from the Northeast, senator from Connecticut.
There are two of them.
Right.
It's probably more than two
Everyone else is named Aiden.
He's openly called for a reevaluation of that relationship. Does this bill force the administration's hand in some sense on that, or is this viewed as sort of an independent? Is moving on a different track than the diplomatic relationship more broadly?
I think that this was a little bit different. I actually just did a quick fact check to see if Chris Murphy voted for JASTA, and it looks like he did. But I was going to say that I think that JASTA is a little bit different than some of Murphy's, I think, in my opinion, more nuanced proposals for reexamining the U.S.-Saudi relationship. He was on our podcast talking about how we probably shouldn't be sending the Saudis heavy weaponry to be using against Yemeni children in hospitals who are being bombed by the Saudis. I think JASTA is a little more controversial because implicit in the bill is a suggestion that Saudi Arabia is responsible for the 9/11 attacks. And while there is evidence that the 9/11 hijackers in some cases had ties to officials in the Saudi government, it hasn't been proven, and it would be a drastic overstatement to say that the Saudi government plotted the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
But by the logic that of the Afghan invasion, and certainly if we're going to hold Saddam Hussein responsible with the Iraq invasion, the connections between the Saudis and September 11th are much stronger, right?
Much stronger than Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
And his non-existent
ties. Yeah, but I mean, God, I hope that's not
controversial.
I hope that's not the level of which we're using assign blame for terrorist attacks now that we have moved past that ill-fated presidency.
But the rationale behind, at least that was publicly stated behind the invasion of Afghanistan, was if you harbor terrorists, we're going to come after you.
Right.
And so the fact that there were a bunch of Saudis flying planes into our building, whether the government, was tied to them or not, you can see why there would be people who would, okay, well, if this is the standard we set in Afghanistan, this is something we should be looking at more seriously.
What's interesting is there actually is a much higher precedent to holding somebody responsible in a federal court than for just bombing the shit out of their country. We can argue about whether or not that is a good thing or not. But the idea that you could bring a sovereign state to U.S. courts for something like this is pretty unprecedented since that 1976 law that you're talking about. And one of the biggest reasons that I think the president opposes this law isn't just because it would really, really upset the Saudis, is because the U.S., reciprocity, the U.S. is responsible for a lot of things abroad that other countries could look at and say, hey, you guys are supporting what we see as a terrorist activity. Can we hold you responsible in our courts? And I think that's something that Obama has the foresight to see.
That's what I wanted to ask about. Obviously, this comes at a time where also the Saudis are feeling a little bit on the outs with America because the Iran deal itself they felt like maybe more of a cleavage with us when we started trying to pass that. But the issue of sovereign immunity is exactly what Josh Earnest has brought up, is the reason why the Obama administration will veto this bill. My question is there a clear-cut case for reciprocity if this bill gets passed? Does it really officially, formally establish a precedent that we could be sued?
There's no automatic legal trigger there.
And more to the point, my question is, we have plaintiffs, they sue Saudi Arabia in federal court. What kind of judgment gets rendered in this court? And how do you enforce that judgment? Is this a monetary judgment? Is someone going to go to space jail over this?
It would likely be monetary. I think the best precedent we've seen is there was recently a Supreme Court case about whether victims of an Iranian-sponsored terror attack could hold the Iranian government responsible. The Supreme Court upheld a ruling that allocated a lot of money, millions or billions, I'm spacing right now, to the family members of the victims of this terror attack. But on the point of enforcement, the Iranians have said this is outright against international law. And interestingly, Jack Goldsmith, who is a Bush-era lawyer, he said, this probably isn't completely legitimate with international law. And he wrote probably the best op-ed in defense of Obama vetoing JASTA.
And with the Saudis, you would in this case be sort of relying on the fact that the United States still has a diplomatic relationship with them for any of these judgments to go through. So you would have, on the one hand, the United States sending money and guns to Saudi Arabia, and then on the other hand, sometimes taking some of that money back. It's sort of a circle that doesn't necessarily make any sense. You could imagine the government getting around this by just the United States government getting around the actual monetary penalties by just upping what we send to Saudi Arabia.
You know, one question I had for you, Zach, is the Saudis have said that if this bill gets passed, and if it's overridden, then it gets passed. They've threatened to sell off some 750 billion, million, I forget the amount.
I'm having trouble with that today.
Yeah, I wrote it down. $750 billion in U.S. Treasury securities. And that doesn't seem to me to be much of a threat. I mean, that seems to me that it would be something that might actually hurt Saudi Arabia economically. And then they could perhaps sue themselves in court for active economic terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of like it's just an economic mess. I mean, the idea that you can actually find buyers for $750 billion worth of securities, even the most liquid securities in the world, which U.S. Treasury bonds are, find $750 billion is a lot of money. So being able to actually sell those off in such a way that would be damaging, you'd have to do it all at once. You'd have to sell at a really low price. And that would also affect the relationship between the U.S. dollar and Saudi Arabian currency. So it would actually end up probably being pretty bad for the Saudi Arabian labor market. It would be bad for the position of their currency internationally. There would be things that it would do for Saudi Arabia that are not great. I think that's just sort of waving a flag and saying, hey, we're really angry and we will do something to retaliate against you if you do this, because this is internationally insulting and humiliating, which I guess I wanted to ask you about, Jessica. Like, even if the monetary stuff doesn't matter, even if this law ends up getting overturned in the Supreme Court because it's against decades of international precedent, what kind of signal does it send, and how meaningful is the sort of like intangible perception that a law like this creates with both the Saudi Arabia and with the broader world?
Oh, well, I think it shows. So after 9/11, you had a slew of Saudi lobbyists descending on Capitol Hill, trying to kind of mitigate the damage that was coming out of having a bunch of Saudi hijackers ram airplanes into the World Trade Centers. And they've been largely successful. I mean, Saudi Arabia's reputation over the past 15 years has improved dramatically. I think the war in Yemen was sort of one of the first things that really started to backtrack the progress that these lobbyists had made. And the 28 pages being released, which did sort of point to some connections between the Saudi government and the hijackers, was also not so good for the government. But at the same time, it's too soon to say that members of Congress, at least, are really ready to throw their hands up in the air with the U.S.-Saudi relationship. I mean, this measure that we talked about earlier with Chris Murphy trying to block an arms sale to Saudi Arabia, very, very far from widespread bipartisan consensus on that. I think we had 64 members of the House out of 365 saying that they wanted to block the arms transfer. And there's four senators on a bill that would block the transfer. So I think in terms of actually having a tangible change in the U.S. relationship to Saudis, which is so deeply based in providing them with weapons, we're still not really there yet.
Which is strange, because you're also, at least the way you've described this, changing international law essentially to allow the United States government to sue a foreign government in U.S. courts would itself still be a really big change.
It would be huge, but I think there's a bit more of a domestic political force at play here, obviously. I mean, the senators that you saw coming out the most in favor of this early on were people who came from New York, whose constituents are obviously very, very in favor of anything that would allow them to get money from the alleged perpetrators of those crimes.
Last question. You talked about how Obama was able to successfully apply pressure during the Iran deal to get Democrats back on his side and to stop bucking him. Obviously, he had to go through channels, leaders in the House and Senate. How do the leaders in the House and Senate on the Democratic side align themselves with this bill? Do they see it the president's way? I know Chuck Schumer does not.
Well, the incoming majority leader, Chuck Schumer, he is one of the fiercest advocates of JASTA. Harry Reid, I think, will have less influence, even if Obama is able to get through to him, because he's on his way out, as is Obama. So I think that the political pressure we saw being applied on the Iran deal is just not really going to be as powerful here.
I didn't check, but does Hillary Clinton weigh in on this bill?
I have not seen.
I think it would be politically unwise of her to at the moment.
Yeah, probably so.
Clinton and Sanders both back it.
All right. Well, there you go. Political wisdom aside, she backs the bill.
Drink JASTA, stay up all night.
All right. Thanks, Jessica, for talking about JASTA. Thanks, Zach, for helping us to properly brand JASTA for the millennial generation. And we'll be right back.
And we're back. I am Zach Carter, joined as usual by
Jason Linkins.
And we have on the phone with us today a very special guest,
a professor
of history from the University of California at Davis. His name is Eric Rauchway, and he is the author of the new-ish book, came out at the end of last year, The Moneymakers: How Roosevelt and Keynes Ended the Depression, Defeated Fascism, and Secured a Prosperous Peace. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. It's still available in finer bookstores near you, I'm sure.
I found it in a sort of not-so-fine bookstore near me, but the book itself was great.
It's good to have your book at disreputable bookstores, too. I found it's just like a good thing.
Well, you want to reach all the readers.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Eric, you've written a lot about the New Deal and FDR over the course of your career. And I think most people who at least are listening to this podcast are familiar with, you know, some of the major tenets of the New Deal, you know, the creation of the SEC, deposit insurance, Social Security, all of these things. But your book, your latest book, suggests that maybe the most radical thing he did was something totally different. What was that?
Well, it was to change the character of the United States dollar. Monetary policy, a very unusual form of monetary policy, to be sure, was central to Roosevelt's legislative and policy agenda from the point of his election right through to his death. That's what the story is about.
So I think for a lot of people, when we think about the Depression, you know, we think about bread lines and people being out of work and all the rest. How did Roosevelt change the money to make people go to work? I don't know if there's an obvious connection there for people who aren't economics dorks like yourself.
Well, I'm happy to be included as an economics dork, but just for the sake of argument, let's look at the most basic aspect of the situation. Remember, the principal problem in the Depression was falling prices, which is to say deflation. So prices were going down, and the effect of deflation and also of the expectation of deflation is to reduce economic activity. And if you take 5 seconds to think about that, you'll understand why that's true. What's happening with deflation, as prices go down, that means the dollar in your pocket is worth more and more as time passes. So if you have an optional purchase of any kind, you're more likely to delay it because, of course, you're going to be able to get that item cheaper next month than you will this month if you have the expectation of deflation. So as prices, you know, and this is because with unemployment, people who sell stuff are bidding for scarcer consumer dollars. So what do? They lower the price. And again, as this is an optional purchase, people are more likely to defer it, and so they put it off, and then retailers will lower the price again. And you still don't have quite as much economic activity you like. You don't have as many sales as you like, so you begin laying people off. And those are more people who are not going to be buying things, which increases the incentive to lower prices, and you get a deflationary spiral, and it's self-reinforcing, until and unless you can administer some kind of shock which changes people's expectations. And this is what Roosevelt does, the very first thing he does coming into office, which is to induce the expectation of inflation.
And so he does this by changing the relationship between the dollar and gold. So how did the gold standard encourage deflation, and what did Roosevelt do to sort of take the country off the gold standard?
Well, the gold standard means that you're committed to exchange your paper currency for a certain fixed amount of gold. And in practice, the way that's implemented is that you're limited in the amount of money you can issue by the amount of gold you have on hand. So over the long term, even if there are no shocks to the system, the more people there are, the more stuff there is, if the amount of gold remains fixed, you're going to have deflation, because it's a simple supply and demand thing. There's only so much gold, and there's more stuff. And that's as if there's no shocks. Excuse me, sorry about that. Of course, the period between World War One and the New Deal, there are a number of shocks to do with international debt, to do with central banks hoarding gold, and to do with an increasing scarcity of gold in circulation. So with you have this deflationary problem that as people are withdrawing money from circulation, as they're withdrawing gold from circulation, money is becoming more valuable and prices are going down.
And the gold standard wasn't just something that America did. This was this is kind of a wider belief in the way money should be valued. And Roosevelt changed this, I think, for everyone across the globe, didn't he?
Yeah, well, Roosevelt's, you're absolutely right that this is an international gold standard, you know, with some modifications that prevailed certainly since World War I and indeed before that. And the general orthodox was that this is a good thing, that forcing central banks to limit the money supply by some arbitrary constraint, like convertibility to gold, you know, will prevent inflation, and that's a good thing, which is fine as long as you're in the business of selling or renting money. If you're in the business of selling or renting any other thing, it's actually not very good for you, especially if you're a debtor, right?
Right.
Your debts get worse.
Yeah. So Roosevelt, you're right. Roosevelt not only takes the dollar off gold immediately on coming into office, but very shortly thereafter says that he wants to establish a new international system, not based on the gold standard, that will make it easier for countries to respond to economic crises by using their monetary policy.
And these ideas were not, you know, Roosevelt was a smart guy, but he didn't come up with this stuff all by his own, on his own. And you have another major character in your book, a guy named John Maynard Keynes. How did Keynes come to these ideas, and how did he transmit them to FDR?
Well, Keynes is, as you know, is a towering figure in the history of 20th century economics. And because we associate him with the idea of responding to a depression with fiscal stimulus, what we usually omit, much as we usually omit it from the New Deal, is that the bulk of Keynes's writings are to do with monetary policy, actually. Mm-hmm. And this comes from the very beginning of his career. His first book is about the Indian currency and the way in which the Indian currency was administered in the waning days of British colonialism, or waning years, decades of British colonialism, which was to say not according to a gold standard, and he envisioned that as being the future. And he continued to write in that vein from his first book, 1913, onwards, believing that flexibility in response to crisis would be the core of a future monetary policy.
But this is still a gutsy thing to do in 1932, 1933, where, you know, the country's been in a terrible, terrible recession, and it's been on gold for quite some time now, to say, okay, we're gonna effectively force the belief that, you know, our money matters because our political system is strong and good, instead of because of you know, our sort of international credibility with this holding of gold. I mean, this is a bit of a gamble that on Roosevelt's part.
Oh, it's a huge shift, and it's one that he goes through in a very cautious and advised fashion. It was one of his advisors would later say Roosevelt's genius was for babying things along. And that's what he does with, you know, not only with the gold standard, but with many other things, including, of course, anti-fascist policies. He doesn't say right away, okay, today I am president and we shall go off the gold standard.
Right.
You know, as a friend of mine who's managed a couple of currency devaluations in modern countries says, you know, you always announce this, you know, at 6 p.m. on Friday that you're going to devalue the currency.
Good idea, always. Friday news dump.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and Roosevelt, you know, does the same thing. He said, well, we're going to suspend the trading in gold, and we'd like everyone to bring back the gold into the banks, and people begin to do that. You know, that's accompanied by his bank holiday and his sending around inspectors to certify, you know, with some kind of good housekeeping seal of approval,
right,
that banks are safe, right? So people do respond favorably to that. They do bring back their money. They do bring back their gold. And once he's got almost all the gold back, he says, oh, by the way, now you can't have it anymore. You know, we're gonna proceed with a policy of managing the currency. But he kind of eases into that because, as you say, it's a radical idea and one that he wants people to get used to.
Well, I wanted to ask, I'm sure that this decision met with some resistance, and even to this day, there are people in some quarters who advocate bringing back the gold standard, including occasional semi-credible presidential candidates and whatnot. How would you characterize the resistance to the idea? Were they making the same arguments then as those who still talk about it do now?
Just to be clear, by semi-credible, you mean Donald Trump? I mean, current Republican candidate for president?
I mean,
Ted Cruz was very vocal about this during
Ted
the primary
Cruz too.
As well.
Yeah.
Cruz certainly talked about it more, but Trump did say that he's pro-gold standard, you know, but in the way that he's pro lots of things, which is without copious details, right? But,
yeah.
It's really, and that kind of thing, is, I think, is the key getting back into why people say they're in favor of it. You know, there's a rhetorical appeal to the gold standard that, you know, surpasses any kind of actual policy effect, right? When we talk about how is a dollar trading with other currencies, if it's valued more than other currencies, what do we say? We say it's a strong dollar.
Right.
Well, obviously, strong is better than weak, right? I mean, it's sort of, you know. Well,
in terms of health, yeah, usually.
You know, if you're in the business of selling dollars, that's great. If you're in the business of selling stuff for dollars,
right.
So, but people just hear strong and, oh, strong, good, right? And just like, you know, people talk about a hard currency. Well, a hard currency is obviously better than a soft currency, right? I mean, it stands to reason, especially if there's a kind of gendered component. Not to say that a Trump candidacy would have any gendered kind of component.
Oh, no,
no evidence of that in the campaign at all.
So things that are strong and hard are obviously better than things that are weak and soft, unless, of course, you're not using metaphors and you're actually looking at what the economic effect is.
Just to maybe give people an idea, because we haven't lived on the gold standard in a long time, but for ordinary people, if we were to flip a switch tomorrow and go back on the gold standard, how would that affect people's lives? I imagine it would be an enormous benefit to the plutocratic class, just like everything else is, but what it would be for like people at ground level?
Well, I mean, again, it's very hard to know how this would happen.
Sure.
But I mean, given that the effect of a gold standard should be broadly deflationary, this would be really lousy for people who have debts, which is, you know, most of us, but especially those of us who are younger.
Like Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, indeed. So, I mean, again, if you're thinking about the circumstances of 1933 and maybe how they might have played out in 2007-8, you know, let's say more recently, if you experience a period of deflation, if you're a debtor, that's terrible because you're being asked to pay back your debts in money that's more expensive than the money you borrow, right? So I think for those of us who are carrying debts, anything like that would be pretty awful.
All right. Well, Eric Rauchway, the book is called The Moneymakers. It is about FDR and John Maynard Keynes. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins, and this week we were joined by author and historian Eric Rauchway, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Jessica Schulberg, and Lauren Weber. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. We want to thank all of you for listening, and we miss you already.